This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekiness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Critics say we should be watching these movies.
But we're here to see if they're right.
Join us as we take a cinematic journey through independent and classic film.
So dim the lights.
And get ready for the show.
This is Art House Legends Podcast, where high art and geek culture collide. Welcome to the podcast that should be wrapped in two condoms and duct taped. This is the Movie Dude Eric, and along with me are...
This is Kent, and if it was never new and it never gets old, then it's a folk song.
Hey, this is Chris, and I don't see a lot of money here.
That's because we haven't made enough podcasts. Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe I said too much. This episode, we're discussing Inside Llewyn Davis, starring Oscar Isaac, Carey Mulligan, Justin Timberlake, John Goodman, and Adam Driver, directed by Joel and Ethan Coen. Gentlemen, it's been a while since we've done the Coen brothers. I think the last one we did was The Big Lebowski, I think about 2 years ago.
Was it Lebowski or Fargo?
No, it was Lebowski. Fargo was our first Coen.
Okay.
So, yeah. So Lebowski was the last one, and I think I gushed my most in that one. I don't know. I seem to gush when it comes to the Coens, although I did fail Fargo. So
the dude does not gush. The dude abides.
Well, I'm not the dude, so.
But you're the movie dude. So abide.
Ooh. The movie dude.
Yes.
And, this podcast ties it all together, man.
Yeah.
But that's not this movie. This movie, we're talking about Inside Llewyn Davis. I have to admit, out of all the other Coen Brothers movies that we could be talking about, we could be talking about Raising Arizona, or we could be talking about No Country for Old Men. Kent, why are we talking about Inside Llewyn Davis?
Honestly, I just keep seeing that one clip over and over, and it just looks interesting, and I just had to see this movie and decide to talk about it. And we'll get to
clip that.
We'll get to that clip later. So the clip that ends the Star Wars by bringing the factions together to sing. Come on.
Ah, that scene.
Yeah.
All right. But now, Chris, this is your first time talking Coens with us. So what's your familiarity with the Coen brothers? What films are you familiar the most with? Which ones do you like, don't like?
I've seen, I want to say, about 80% of their stuff. I haven't seen a lot of their early stuff, like pre-Fargo, I think.
Oh, man, dude, you're missing out on some great stuff right there.
Let me see. I'm bringing it up. Yeah.
Because I'll tell you right now, Blood Simple is a must-see, and so is, I can't believe I forgot the title of it.
I've seen Blood Simple.
Right on the tip of my tongue, too.
I've seen Blood Simple and Barton Fink, which I like
Barton Fink
cover.
A good one.
Yeah.
Barton Fink is an underappreciated Coen Brothers film, in my opinion. But, oh my goodness, I can't believe I forgot the title of it. It's like right there on the tip of my tongue, too.
I've been hearing great things about Miller's Crossing, and I've never seen that.
Yeah, Miller's Crossing.
Yeah.
You have to see Miller's Crossing.
Yeah. It's been on a mean-to-see list forever, and I just haven't gotten to it yet. So
there's a scene in Miller's Crossing that will make you question why John Turturro doesn't have an Oscar yet. That's all I have to say.
Okay.
And that's saying something, especially after you've seen Barton Fink.
Yeah.
But... All right, so at this particular point, let's go ahead and let's talk about Inside Llewyn Davis. Now, this is actually a more recent Coen Brothers film.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say this is probably even one of the more independent films that they've done. Especially more recently, they've been doing a lot of films that have pretty big budgets. And this one, for a period piece, kind of has a sense of, well, limited budget, so to say. And I just have to ask, when it comes to the what the Coens are capable of doing, did this have any impact on how you saw the film?
Budget-wise? No, not really. I think I kind of liked it more because it was kind of, I don't know.
More intimate?
Yeah. The whole, like, struggling artist thing is kind of, I guess, speaks to me in a way. more than just like a big budget kind of movie does, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it for me, when you're going a budget and you're doing something historical, most of the budget is probably securing the period vehicles and making sure everything looks like the right time frame. Which, yeah, it's looked it. I didn't have any thoughts about budget watching it. It was like, okay, I feel immersed in the time period. I'm fine. I don't need the big explosions of a multi-billion-dollar movie. But it just was there. It was, the money went to the people. So
now, well, actually, I want to say that most of the money probably went to T-Bone Burdett. But
yeah, probably.
But I will say that this is also practically the second musical that the Coen brothers have ever made.
Hmm.
Out of curiosity, have y'all seen Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
I have, but it was like, it's been like a lifetime and I need to see it again.
What about you, Kent?
I haven't seen it.
Well, I guess after this, would you go and catch Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
I've only heard the plot of it and basically told it was a modern Odyssey.
Well, it's an Odyssey set in the 1930s.
Yeah. Well, okay, we're closer to the 1930s than we are to the Trojan War, so it's modern, quote-unquote. But
honestly, I have to go back and see it again because when I saw it in theaters, I actually didn't like it, but I'm starting to think that perhaps I was just in the wrong mindset. Now, when I'm thinking back on it now, I'm starting to think about it fondly, so I might need to give it just another watch.
I remember really liking it, yeah.
I mean, it's just that, you know, whenever I think about Oh Brother, Where Art Thou fondly, I'm thinking about the Man of Constant Sorrow and the songs in the movie, which, of course, was a like multi-platinum selling soundtrack for the Coens. And it was also the first time that they worked with T-Bone Burnett for the soundtrack. And they've worked with him pretty much ever since when it comes to doing music for their movies, whether it's a musical or not. But here, they're writing their own songs. And for the exception of maybe like one or two songs, these are all original compositions. And I guess that leads me to my next question. What's your familiarity with folk music, and what do you think of the songs in this movie, outside of what they do in the movie itself?
Somewhere around here, I have a textbook on folk songs of Indiana. I actually had a class my last year that's like looking around going, damn it, we need electives. We actually like... Our group of like four friends ended up in a class of like seven people that were just focused on folk, basically the folk traditions of Indiana, and a big part of it was music because our professor for it actually had a degree in folk music and the blues to go with his linguistics and his what we might call real degrees. But actually, he's on iTunes too if you look him up.
Have you ever seen A Mighty Wind?
Yes. So.
And what was your impression of the music and the movie itself?
That's it. Well, there's kind of a difference between folk music of the late 60s and later and folk music of prior to that period. Because a lot of the earliest folk music that we've seen is actually could be seen as the commoners' historical retelling. Before you had libraries, before you had everything digitized, you could sing a song that talked about an event happening, and you knew what happened. Now, we don't really see that in this movie, but, yeah.
Well, the music scene of the 50s is kind of a revisioning of the older Irish folk songs, specifically. And which folk music kind of has its hands in country music. It has its hands in more classical dirges, lots of spoken word, a lot of spoken word stuff also comes from that. It is telling historical epics. In a way, I think that's one of the reasons why some of that did find its way in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou as well, where they're kind of singing dirges in that movie as well. But there is, especially with this movie and the folk music that we're getting here, they're not so much stories, but more kind of emotional elements, right?
Yes.
But Chris, what about you? What is your familiarity with folk music?
It's pretty minimal, honestly. I don't know a lot about it. I mean, I like what I've heard, but I couldn't like...
So you're not going to go out and start a folk music category on your iTunes? Or
maybe next year, start, you know, maybe.
Old LPs?
Yeah, maybe in the future, but not now.
Get yourself a hipster cred a little bit?
Ugh. No, now you ruined it, so.
Hey, there's nothing wrong with being a hipster unless you're a normal human being.
Oh!
There goes the hipster audience.
We just lost half our audience.
Oh.
Oops. All right, so let's get into the film itself. Now, this is talking about the folk music scene of the early 60s, just before, obviously, the super big one comes and changes the game forever, something that's very much hinted at the very end of this film. But the main protagonist here is Llewyn Davis, obviously, because his name's on the title, and he is played by Oscar Isaac. Out of curiosity, what do y'all think about Llewyn Davis as a character and as a human being? Ken?
Yeah. He's trying, but nothing's working.
Well, do you like him?
You know, first time through, sort of. Second time through, in some ways, he's reminding me of me the last few years, while I'm trying to get these new gigs going, where I can turn something full-time, and it's, just kind of not working out.
So there's something relatable about him?
Yeah.
That you kind of are taking personally?
Yeah.
What about you, Chris?
I like certain things about him, and I don't think he tries to be an asshole, but oftentimes he is. And I guess I don't always like him, but I kind of understand why he does what he does, I guess.
Well, I guess another question that should be asked is, do you think that he likes himself?
Not a whole lot if he does, I don't think.
So what do you think has made him this way? What do you think has happened in his life that has caused him such pain for him to kind of act out?
It seems like the... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say that he hasn't hit it big, and probably whatever happened to his partner.
Yeah.
Well, we know what happened
to
his partner.
Well, we know he killed himself. We don't know the whys and how long ago that was, and so out of...
Well,
things about that we don't know.
I mean, kind of taking how the film acts and kind of the way things look, and keep in mind that even at the end, beginning of the film, that Llewyn even says they weren't really even a big thing. They had one sort of hit.
Yeah.
Or, you know,
oh,
it's not one
that
that's
one,
going to
yeah.
be paying dividends, but, you know, what do you think happened to him? I mean, what's your best guess?
Music wasn't going the way they wanted to, and he took it personally. That was my guess.
It's probably the closest thing. Unless there's... unless he had a woman, too.
Just take from what the film is saying, though.
Yeah.
Don't try to add more to it.
Yeah.
Instead of drudging along.
The whole, you know, he thought that he was a space alien, and he decided
to
save his life instead of invade the world. I think we've had that argument before when it comes to implying things that aren't supported in the film.
Or he got with Gene, too, and... Oh.
Well, it is no... It seems like Gene has enjoyed the company of quite a few individuals.
Yeah.
But, again, I don't know. Honestly, I'm going to have to agree with Chris on this one. And I'm also going to... But another question that I probably... needs to be, or that I think that needs to be asked is, How do you think Lewin took this suicide?
Probably very badly in all ways. So, but he probably personally more than professionally.
I can't tell if he blames himself for it or...
I don't think he blames himself.
I don't think so either, yeah.
Well, take the when he's doing the song at the dinner table, and when the hostess starts singing the other side of the duet,
right?
You know, he automatically stops the song. So I don't think that it's something personal. I mean, I think it is personal, but I think that he's putting up a front about how he feels about it, that he's trying to bury how much that it hurt him,
mm-hmm.
and that it's causing him to get cold and mean to an extent. I almost want to say that a lot of reasons. I don't think that he was a saint or happy. Actually, no, I take it back. I think he was happy when it was him and his partner, because look at the album cover, of their album that we saw at the beginning.
Yeah,
you know, he's fresh faced. He looks happy. He looks like he's doing something he loves.
Clean shaven.
It's clear that he loves his music.
Yeah,
he loves doing the music that he does. I think that he knows that, you know, especially when we get to the critic and near the end of the film, when he tells him what he thinks. I think Lewin knows this too. I think Lewin, you know, that he's trying his hardest to make a name for himself, and he doesn't want to get caught up with someone else, someone that'll also leave him. In a way, I think that especially how he's treated people, especially with how we see how he treats people, I think that he is dealing with abandonment issues to an extent. You know, it's better if I leave them. It's better if I distance myself from them, because then they can't hurt me to an extent. And of course, when the critic says, or you know, the producer says, well, you know, find someone else. What does he say? Not going to happen. I don't think it's ego. I think it's fear.
Lack of trust.
Well, would you?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. This is one of the things I have to admire about Joel and Ethan Coen. And this is actually something that I really didn't catch the first time I saw this movie. And I should go ahead and state that the first time that I saw Inside Llewyn Davis in the theaters, after the movie's over, I was confused. I didn't exactly know what it was that the Coens were going for with this film. And it was only during the time that I watched it for this podcast that I got a better idea. Now, I'm going to kind of come out and say, I still am trying to work things out about the movie. This is one of those that I have a feeling I'm going to have to see a few more times to really get down what I think that this film is about. But I think a lot of what the Coens are dealing with is kind of anxiety. And I think in a way, Joel and Ethan Coen wrote this as perhaps talking, as a discussion amongst themselves about what happens if Joel and Ethan Coen go their own way, or what happens if one of them dies? What if that team is split up? How would the other move on with this art? You know, considering the how amazing they've been over almost a 40-year, you know, 40-year film span. You know, how would they move on? But do you kind of see that in the work, or do you think I'm pushing it too far?
I mean, I think about the same thing. I was thinking more of if they had an idea for a movie and it wasn't something the studio liked or whatever, something like that. Or was this kind of like, it feels like a passion project to me, like a, already mentioned it, struggling artist kind of deal.
Now, it should be said that the Coen brothers are Academy Award winners. They've been Academy nominated several times. They've won for No Country for Old Men. They have done studio films. They have done private indie films. And as in a very successful career, Inside Llewyn Davis was released by CBS Films. Now, do I have to tell you exactly how low on the production, you know, on a studio side it is to get CBS Films? I mean, in a way, CBS Films, if I'm not correct, has actually closed down And at this point, if they had made this film right now, it would have probably been straight to Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Does that mean they approached the other studios and they passed on it? Or was it always with CBS Films?
Well, here's the thing. This went to the film festivals, and I believe that it actually won the Grand Prix at Cannes, if I'm not correct.
Wow.
Now, bear in mind that just because it wins Cannes, especially if it wins Cannes, that doesn't mean that it's going to get distribution very easily.
Right.
Although, most likely, if it ever does that, it usually goes to Sony Pictures Classics. Because right. pretty much that's where Sony Pictures Classics basically puts most of their money is on the Cannes circuit. Sometimes they'll do the Sundance, sometimes they'll do maybe something from Telluride, but most of the movies that Sony Pictures Classics does is in the Cannes circuit. That said, I can definitely understand why studios would be very hesitant to be releasing this movie. I mean, let's put it this way. If you were to say that this movie, Inside Llewyn Davis, was the song that Llewyn Davis played for F. Murray Abraham,
mm-hmm.
would he be saying anything different about the movie as he is about the song?
I almost wonder if they put that line in there just because they knew that.
I almost guarantee you that's exactly, and I think that's especially why why it's actually worded the way it was when F. Murray Abraham says, "Play me something from Inside Llewyn Davis," and he does, and he's like, "Oh, it's good,
yeah,
but it's not sellable."
Yeah.
By the way, I love that scene. I love that scene, and. Oh, man. There's a lot of scenes that, especially the second time around, I've actually come to love a lot. The first time around, I think that it was just because I was trying to figure everything out that I didn't appreciate as much as on the second viewing. But did either of you see it more than one time, or did y'all just see it once for this podcast?
Twice. I just finished one up right before we recorded. So.
I saw it in 2013, they sent out the screeners for it for critics, and I've watched it a few times since then. Not as much as I've liked, because my girlfriend fucking hates the movie. Yeah. Anything with cats that are, like, abused in any way? Nope. Oh. Fucking hate it. Yeah.
Well, was the cat abused, or is the cat abusing them?
Doesn't matter. The cat got hurt. That's it. It's over.
Speaking, you don't actually see the cat get hurt, and we don't know for a fact that it's a cat. For all we know, it was just a really furry bunny.
Well, we don't know for a fact if he actually
there was blood, and it was limping.
There was blood. No, there was blood on the bumper. So
we don't know if that whole thing was a hallucination.
Again, there's blood on the bumper.
He could have hallucinated the blood.
He's never hallucinated in the movie prior to that, so but he doesn't exactly drink.
He's very tired, though.
He is very tired, and I wouldn't mind him.
I've hallucinated when I'm tired. I mean,
are you hallucinating right now?
No, this 8-foot-tall bunny beside me is telling me that I'm not hallucinating. So,
can you do anything, kind of deal.
Yeah, keeps messing with the fan.
No Donnie Darko references?
I didn't even think that. I was going to
Where did the movie?
Anyway, where were we? Cats. No. Well, actually, the cats throughout this movie are just...
This is the most docile cat. Oh my god. Like, I have 5 cats. None of them are that calm in the car.
Yeah.
I was about to say that, like, considering the cat runs away, what, like, 3 times? I should say 2.5, because the second time he does kick it and keep it in the
Or how long he holds it and it doesn't, like, squirm or, like, scratch him in the face. I'm like, holy shit, this fucking cat, man.
He has it on Xanax.
Maybe,
Let's be honest here. It is a rich Greenwich Village couple that he lives with. So you know they have them on some sort of pill.
Yeah.
Where's my scrotum is a great fucking line. Or where's the scrotum or whatever. It's a great line. It's amazing.
The funny thing is when he found the cat, I knew that exactly was going to be the joke.
That it was going to be the wrong sex.
Did you still laugh, though? I bet you still laughed, right?
I guess what it is so when it comes to that scene, it is so uncomfortable. You know, after he has his meltdown and, you know, she goes back to the bedroom and, you know, we get to this point where it's just kind of like we're all just kind of calming down from the hysterics from the dinner table, and for her to kind of scream and come out with the cat, I guess for me is like I was kind of like, what's gonna happen next? And then it just jump cuts with him in the car, getting to the car with the cat. So it's like it kind of denies you of kind of what happens next, other than, you know, it kind of implies what happens next, or at least I thought that I knew what happens next until, you know, the next time he shows up at the door and is like, oh, it's all underwater on the bridge.
Yeah.
Like, okay. Although I have to admit, though, when they did the whole water on the bridge the second time, I did have a ladybird type thing. Like, this guy's a real jerk to you and you're just letting him come back to your house. Like, but at the same time, I also realized they're using him, right? He's their folk singer friend.
Yeah.
They always have guests over. Like,
all the time. Yeah.
Oh, well, come in and sing a song. It's like, what the fuck? Yeah. I'd be pissed too, you know?
But I will say, though, that for the longest time, though, considering how many of the people he's hanging out with kind of have some, I don't want to say very strong Jewish ties, but there's definitely a lot of...
You got that feeling, too? Yeah.
Well, I thought that Lewin might have been Jewish, but he has, you know, his father's Welsh and his mother was Italian. And while there could be Welsh Jews or Italian Jews, I don't know. And let's be honest here, Oscar Isaac would never be, doesn't have any of the very strong Jewish physical traits, you know, especially for Puerto Rican.
Guatemalan.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
It's one of those things like, yeah, I guess maybe I'm pushing a little bit too hard on this, but it is interesting, you know, maybe it's just because of the music industry, just how much, you know, you would kind of come around Jewish people in that industry, I guess. But anyway, I kind of feel bad and I kind of hate his manager, right?
Useless.
I'll get you this coat, but it's like, okay, well, where's my payment? Why do you have to talk about payments? Coat. Like, poor guy.
Well,
I mean, poor Lewin, not.
Yeah, well, I get the feeling that maybe Lewin's music isn't selling anyway, so he has nothing to give him business related, but
he
does feel bad for him.
But at the same time, though, F. Murray Abraham, you know, he kind of implies that that he does this with everybody. So,
yeah.
I don't know. It's just one of those things like, yeah, it might be that you know, Lewin's music isn't selling at all. Or it could be that, well, it's selling dismally. I mean, there's no success. And if it were successful, his manager would be giving him proceeds to kind of get him back into the studio. But, you know, the little that he's getting, you know, his manager's basically taking him for everything, right? And it doesn't help that when Lewin gets a big break on a really big song, hint, hint.
Yeah. Please, Mr. Kennedy.
I know we're about to talk about. you know, he takes the payout and he completely gives up the ability to get residuals.
Or royalties, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, royalties. And especially at the very movie when they make it clear, oh, this is going to be a big hit.
Yeah. What kind of royalties are you getting? Like,
yeah.
Should have known better when he, you know, got with Justin Timberlake and Kylo Ren. So, you know.
Yeah.
well, what do you got to do when you got to pay for an abortion that he didn't even have to pay for because apparently he had one on the house?
Is Carey Mulligan ever not a bitch in a movie?
Oh, like,
I
moved
her in Education. Be careful.
Ever? Like, I don't think I saw that one. So maybe.
You haven't seen An Education?
Mm-mm.
Well, that's your big breakout. And I absolutely loved her in that film.
It seems like every time I've seen her, she sings a song and she's a total bitch. And then
Well, every time you
it seems to me like you've only seen this in Shame.
That's all I can think of offhand.
Okay. Wait, what, oh, wow. What was she in?
I've seen more, but I mean, those are the two. I remember her Never Let Me Go, and she was kind of bitchy in that.
I liked her in Never Let Me Go, which was actually the movie that made me realize that Andrew Garfield was... Well, that and Social Network made me realize that Andrew Garfield was the real deal, and not some pretty face.
Her first role was in Pride and Prejudice, so... 2005, so...
But she was also very young in that movie.
Yeah. But we'll hit her... For me, big one on when we hit Geek Sheet later on.
And just bear in mind though that she's also sharing screen with other future Oscar nominees such as Keira Knightley and Rosamund Pike.
Yeah.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
But all right, so getting back to this movie, Carey Mulligan. By the way, I absolutely have kind of a crush on, and just to let you know, she is the wife of Oscar Isaac's partner. If you didn't notice, the other guy singing Fare Thee Well, besides Oscar Isaac, is none other than Mr. Mumford himself.
Oh, okay.
Y'all didn't know that?
I missed that. All
right, and I should kind of also make note that I had actually just learned about Mumford & Sons about like 4 months before I saw the first trailer for this movie, and as soon as I heard that trailer, I had to find that song that was on the trailer because I freaking love that song. And I still love the song to this day. But we all know that it's no Hey Mr. Kennedy. Just saying.
Nothing is.
No, I take it back. I love Fare Thee Well. Hey Mr. Kennedy is actually, that is a fun song.
Yeah.
Although, if anything, I would have loved to have seen it get nominated for Best Original Song.
I was surprised it wasn't.
Just so that you could have...
all of them on stage singing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Kent, I know this is the scene you've been dying to talk about since you announced this.
This scene is practically a Geek Sheet of itself. I mean, Justin Timberlake has Poe Dameron and Kylo Ren over to sing about outer space. Outer space.
I want a whole Justin Timberlake album in this style. That's what I was hoping his new album would be, because I was like, he did a trailer.
You know what I really want from Justin Timberlake when it comes to this song?
Mm.
A version of Dick in a Box.
Dick?
That would be good.
That'd be great. Dick?
Be careful. I might make us do a Dick in the Box version like that. So be careful. That might be a special feature. Just saying.
Starting to feel a bit hoarse, so.
Probably find clips of Adam Driver saying box and dick enough, so you can.
Chris, you would be the Al Cody of this group. You know it.
Yeah, probably.
Just saying. Start practicing your pronunciations.
Mm-hmm. Oh. But yeah, that song, that was a fun. Well, let's face it, he gets the call. He's not sure about if he has to bring his guitar because he can't hear it because a train passes. Goes without his guitar. But, you know, it's a studio. There's a guitar. So,
of course.
Yeah. So.
Can I say that one of the things that I kind of... that made me really feel like this was a Coen Brothers production was when he gets to the Columbia Studios and it has that Columbia logo... like big and center mass.
Yeah.
That was the moment that I felt like this was a Coen Brothers film. It just that little tidbit, that oversized logo right there. Because especially like how they throw these little, I don't want to say product placements because a lot of these products are no longer there. Like, especially like Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? You know, you had the RCA logos all over the place. You had Woolworths and other 30s, 20s and 30s logos and stuff. You know, Palmade, Dapper Dan Palmade specifically. Just those kinds of those logos everywhere just kind of give you that Coen Brothers feel just a little bit, right? I guess I'm all...
yeah.
That's all right. But were there any aspects of the film that made you kind of realize, oh yeah, this is a Coen Brothers film?
Oh, you know, oddly not.
I'm surprised for both of you that two words didn't come straight out of your mouths.
Oh,
John Goodman.
Oh, yeah. Well, he appears in other people's movies, but yeah.
He does, but I'll be honest here. Anytime I see him in any other movie, the first thing I'm thinking is, wait, is this a Coen Brothers film?
Oh, okay. Good point.
Yeah, watching 10 Cloverfield Lane. Wait a second, is this a Coen Brothers film? Blues Brothers 2000. Oh my, I didn't realize that the Coens yeah. were doing a sequel. Okay, I'm being facetious you get what I mean. But one thing that was sorely lacking in this film was Roger Deakins. Where the hell was he?
Probably busy with something else.
yeah, called Skyfall.
Yeah.
Which he got nominated for, didn't win.
Mm.
Yeah, that was the story of his life until Blade Runner 2049. Yeah. I'm sorry I had to throw that there. I've been wanting to congratulate him for that.
Okay.
But I will say, when it comes to the look of this particular film, what kind of struck out at you? What about the cinematography? What about the lighting or the way that it was shot? Did this kind of feel like in the same vein as other Coen films, or did this feel a bit different?
I don't know about Howard Cohen, but I mean, it felt like a cold winter of not being able to find the warmth of happiness kind of thing.
Just a warm winter coat.
Yeah. I mean, no wonder he likes being around in cars driving. The heater works.
I will say, though, when his foot gets into the icy puddle, even yeah. I kind of...
It's like, ugh. Yeah.
That even hurt me a little bit.
Yeah.
But it does look cold. I will say this is a very cold looking film. It almost chills you a little bit, kind of the way that the breath he's always kind of has, smoke breath.
Yeah.
He's always bundled up. Especially like when he's going, oh no, I'm not cold. Like, fuck you, I know you're cold. Don't.
Well, like the muted colors of the film almost make you imagine the coldness as you're watching it, And like the scene I remember the most is like when he wakes up and he sees Troy eating that fucking bowl of cereal, and the cereal bowl is yellow, but it's like everything else is fucking like gray and sepia tone.
Yeah. It's not even bright yellow. It's like this kind of like mucus yellow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sixties yellow, as I call it. But
hey, remember the '60s was considered the flower power decade.
Not to the end of the '60s. This is 61. I mean, we're kind of still in the '50s here in
this
some ways.
This is John F. Kennedy's 60s.
Yeah. But it's not a good time for a lot of decorations, so...
Well, it's also deep winter in New York, which...
You don't see much green trees out. In fact, you shouldn't see any because it's winter.
Yeah, I was about to say, like, it's winter. Yeah. If you see green trees, then someone didn't do their job right.
If you see green trees, it's got to be a pine, which... Okay, but...
But yeah, I will say that, especially considering that the major colors that seem to be in this film are gray and brown,
mm-hmm.
especially with muted colors, that just, I don't know, for me it's very depressing.
Yeah.
The cat is also like an orangish, but it's like it's not like the regular orange of a cat, it's very dull.
And the cat's trying to escape the movie.
Yep, every chance it gets. Unless it's in the car.
Well, no. I mean, technically, I maybe the cat, escaped the car. And I always wondered, does that mean that the John Goodman character is dead in the car? I mean...
Oh, that
I
was cat wondering ate that. John Goodman's face, man. Come on.
Yeah.
I mean, it is possible that another cop will come around and bust him for being on drugs, too.
Yep.
no doubt that if he had a heroin overdose, that means that he might still have some heroin on him. Yeah. Or at least the paraphernalia will definitely come, will definitely be suspicious, say the least. But that's if someone finds him. He might just turn out to be, you know, just a precursor for another frozen individual in the middle of the snow in another Coen Brothers movie.
Ah, scary.
Yeah, I tied it back.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did that.
Coens love their snow and bleak climates.
That's only because you've only seen 3 Coen Brothers films that I know about, and 2 of them are set in winter.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, he actually does. They actually do other periods, and some of the best films are actually in hot, sunny places.
Next time we do Collins, we're doing something without snow. So there you go.
Yes. Well, there's snow.
That's the one precursor.
Summer. Well, I mean, I get no. Miller's Crossing is in fall. It's
okay.
So no. They've actually done pretty much all 4 seasons. Now that I'm thinking about it.
Okay.
But.
Yeah.
But I will say, though, that I am kind of missing Roger Deakins just a little bit here. I can only imagine what this film would have looked like with Deakins doing the DP.
Mm.
But that said, though, then he wouldn't have been on Skyfall, and Skyfall needed all the help it could get. Oh, I'm sorry. Did I give my opinion on something I shouldn't? Oh, sorry. But, yeah, I've gotten into some fights over that opinion. All right, so we've talked about kind of the character of Lewin. What about the other characters that he comes across? Because in most Coen Brother films, I want to say that there's one structure to all Coen Brother films, is that they always have their main protagonist come across individuals that will give them, I want to say, kind of like a road signs to choices that they can make that'll change their lives, right? So in this case, you have Lewin, who's going from house to house, from couch to couch, dealing with the people on those couches, and those encounters kind of guide him to where he should be going next, right?
Right.
Sort of.
So what do you think are the most important individuals that are changing his life, that are giving him the most to contemplate?
I want to say his sister, but even then, she doesn't really do anything that makes him... He goes and sees his dad because of her, it seems like.
Well, partially.
Yeah.
The thing is, when it comes to the sister character, the way I kind of see it is that of all the people, he most pities her. He sees her as just basically being completely normal, and it scares him how normal she is. She has the normal family. She has the normal life. She doesn't, you know, her life is basically within the confines of the role that she plays, and it terrifies him. In a way, I want to say that that's the reason why he got into music, was to escape that life, to do something different. That he actually enjoys crashing couches, but do you kind of see it that way, or do you think that there's a different take to it, that the sister plays a different role? Ken, feel free to jump in.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of she kind of just pushes the plot along, but...
Well, the father is another one of the things.
Yeah.
And I think that's what he's scared of becoming.
Oh, yeah.
I think that there are 3 major characters that terrify him of who he could become. One is his father. One of them is Jim, Justin Timberlake's character. And one of them is the John Goodman character.
Mm.
I think that all 3 of these characters scare the living shit out of him. He doesn't want to be used up and left in kind of the place that his father was. And that scares him. One of the reasons why he doesn't want to become a merchant marine. He doesn't want to be the sellout that Jim is. That is basically making novelty songs that are probably going to get a lot of airplay, but will pretty much be forgotten after everyone gets their fill of it and move on to the next novelty. You know, I guess you could say the top 40 artist of today, that would be of the 60s.
The one-hit wonder. And,
well, not the one-hit wonder, because, I mean, I guess I should say maybe the Nickelback.
Oh, low.
Oh, yeah. Ouch.
I mean, that's kind of what Mr. Hey, Mr. Kennedy is, right? I mean, it is not meant to be, but just something of its time. It's, even today, it would not even survive the decade, right? Like, there are songs of the 60s that are going to last. There are songs of the 50s that still last.
Right.
Hey, Mr. Kennedy would never reach that pantheon.
I'd say.
And then, of course, there's the John Goodman character who is all about his art to the point that he's basically killing himself, and the only way he can sustain himself is through drugs. And the scene of Lewin driving with John Goodman in the back, especially that goatee, you know, the goatee that John Goodman has looks very much like the beard that Lewin has, right?
Yeah.
And I love how the way that the scene is shot, both faces, Lewin's and John Goodman's faces, are pretty much side by side and as large as each other, making sure that you saw the comparison between the two. And then, of course, you add in when he's talking to the F. Murray
yes.
Abraham, what's one of the suggestions that he tells Lewin to do?
Shave down to a goatee.
So that all ties together, in my opinion. But I could be wrong. I mean, if y'all think it's different or if you think I'm reading too much into it, feel free to...
I don't think that's reading too much into it, so...
I didn't even think of any other that, so...
Yeah. Why don't you look just like this guy who told us to stick up your ass, so...
And then, of course, there's one other person who should probably terrify him more than anything. And that is the guy who was singing after him in the bar.
Bob Dylan.
Because that's the guy that is going to be everything that Lewin wants to be, but never will.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of that, of when they the character known as Young Bob takes the stage, and he starts singing, and you know exactly who that Bob is. Like, that's just brilliant. Because another thing that this movie is also about, this movie is about endings,
yep.
Right?
And looping the ending back to the beginning, or the beginning yep. to the end.
All right, so since you brought it up, let's talk about the ending, because I have to admit, this is one of the things that kind of confused me about the movie the first time I saw it, because the beginning of the film is the same as the end of the film. Now, that could mean that basically we were seeing everything prior to this moment, and then we're kind of looping back around to the ending.
Yeah.
But that doesn't feel right.
Oh.
Because it's not entirely the same as it was in the beginning. There were differences. Minor ones, but there were differences.
So you think it's everything in his life just repeating almost exactly? He's always going to piss somebody off who's going to beat him up behind the bar?
I think until he can finally decide what he's going to do with himself, he's going to keep running in circles. And again, while he's running in circles, you have Young Bob in the background who's going to completely take everything that you're wanting to build. You know, he's not changing, but the world, I guess I should say the times, they are changing.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I had to. I'm sorry. It's like, I feel like the Coens are definitely wanting to make sure to get that across. And as if Lewin doesn't decide what to do with himself, if he doesn't either kind of get with it and find an act that he can build on, because he's not going to make it on his own. He will never be a solo artist. He is not strong enough for that. He has great songs, but he will never be successful on his own. He needs to either decide to kind of play the corporate game a little bit, or basically just keep playing his music until he dies of a really young age, or get on that ship.
Yeah.
And those are really the three options that he has. And I think that in all three instances, he's going to be miserable. The question is, what misery is he willing to accept? And maybe the ending of the film is telling us exactly which one he is going to accept. Right?
Maybe.
Yeah. You know, he could always try and get in the Merchant Marine entertainment. So
all he needs is the $86 to get his license.
I thought he was playing the Gaslight to pay for it, I guess.
That's kind of what I felt like.
Yeah.
But if we're cycling again, that being said, all he's going to do is he's going to go back to that Greenwich Village house. He's going to lose the cat, and he's going to spend that money on yet another abortion. You know?
That he won't have to pay for this time?
Yeah.
Well, he will have to pay for it this time because it's pretty clear that Carrie Mulligan's going to take that abortion.
Yeah, but she didn't. There wasn't, like, official confirmation again.
Maybe she does decide to keep it and just tell Justin Tamer like it's his.
So who do you think the father is?
Well, from the looks of it, there's three options.
Yeah.
There could be more.
Probably.
I love how the nightclub owner puts it. It's like, we always wanted to have Jim and Gene on because, most of the people here want to fuck Gene. And there are even people here who want to fuck Jim, too.
Well, he's Justin Timberlake. So
that is true.
Just didn't throw it out there. But, yeah, I don't know if she'd go for too many groupies, but, club owner, and then there's Ruben, and then there's her husband. I mean,
and the nightclub owner.
Well, I thought I mentioned him.
Yeah.
I mean, for all we know, she could have met, the Gorfins. I mean...
Who knows? Maybe she fucked all the Irish guys.
Ooh.
I'm just saying. I mean,
it was the sweaters, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, I love them sweaters. Of all the costume designs, those sweaters are rock the shit. Just saying. Hell, I'll be one of the I'll be the fifth Irishman. I'll learn it and all. Just saying. But. I guess, all right, so we talked about the music here, but is there a song here that particularly moved you, that you felt the most about?
I'm surprised you guys didn't mention Hang Me, Oh Hang Me. I love that one. So I love the other two that you mentioned as well, but I think that one's probably my favorite.
Hang Me, Oh Hang Me is a good one. I really like that one.
Yeah.
I also love the song that he sang for F. Murray Abraham. I think it's the death of Queen Mary or something.
Oh, Queen Jane? Death of Queen Jane?
Yeah,
that's a good one too.
Yeah, that was a good one. And the song he sang for his father. That, because those are the most intimate. And the thing is that, Llewyn Davis is great at intimate songs. And now that I'm really thinking about it, I think I might have to go and pick up that soundtrack. Because
it's good. They sent it to us.
I have Fare Thee Well.
That's great.
The other songs I really enjoyed too. But again, they're not the same as Hey Mr. Kennedy, but you can't have it all.
Yeah.
If Adam Driver was in the background of every song, I think
He needs to be in the background of every song ever.
you see that's what we need. We need Adam Driver to be at the Grammys singing backup for everybody.
And everybody would win everything, though. So.
Yeah.
just imagine Adam Driver playing Hype Man for, like, Kendrick Lamar.
But can he also have the fake arm from Logan Lucky? Because that would be great.
Oh, man. All right. But, Kent, what about you? Are there any songs that really stuck out to you?
I like the 500 Miles.
That's a good one, too.
Yeah. Of course, I think we could all agree on Please Mr. Kennedy being, the height of all things right now.
If it makes you feel better.
Yes, it does.
All right, gentlemen, is there anything specific that y'all want to bring up about the movie, things that you don't think we talked about enough or that you want to bring up?
I still don't quite get how this film had a credit that said this film is kosher for Passover.
What?
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah, it does.
One of the last final credits. So
I think that's a running gag with the Coens.
Oh, is it?
I think it started with The Serious Man.
Hmm.
Did either of you guys watch the Criterion release of this?
No.
I have not, although I think maybe I'm tipping my hand a little bit here, but I have a strange feeling that it's going to find its way in my collection.
I bought it a few, like, as soon as it came out, and I haven't had a chance to get to the bonus features, so.
Mm.
Yeah. But the booklet is actually a poster, which is interesting, because I haven't seen that in Criterion before.
Oh, no, Criterion's have been doing that more recently.
Okay.
For some of theirs, so.
Like the little, what do they call it? The little essays on the back of it and stuff, like their lyrics almost. It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Ken?
I'm blanking on other things to mention before we move on, but yeah.
Well, I will take that as a no then. So in that case, Kent, why don't you run us down on the geek sheet?
Fear the destructive firepower of this fully armed and operational geek sheet. Hey, this has all three of your geek food groups going for it. So. Right off the bat, our star is Poe Dameron, okay, who is also, who we've talked about before, in Ex Machina, was recently in a movie I haven't seen, but you really want to enjoy talking to somebody about Annihilation?
Yes.
Yes, and...
Yeah, he was, yeah.
Yes, and also, had a role in the last X-Men movie. So
why'd you bring that up, man?
Wishes he could forget about that.
Okay, because it's still X-Men. It's still geeky. So if you include that, it's four basic food groups. Because you got Carey Mulligan, who I first encountered actually on Doctor Who, on Blank, one of the episodes that Neil Gaiman says, "Sit down, shut up, get into Doctor Who, watch Blank." So. Some new fans' first introduction to Doctor Who is through Carey Mulligan. So, Ethan Phillips was Neelix on Voyager. I knew I recognized that voice right away.
The rich guy in the Greenwich Village apartment?
Yes. Well, he's not rich. He's a professor. But
he makes a lot of money. Yeah. He lives in Greenwich Village.
True.
That's
okay.
All I have to say.
Yeah. So there you have your Star Wars, your Doctor Who, and your Star Trek all in one. So, such a culmination. But when you just thought you had one Star Wars, you have Kylo Ren. You have a dark side master going. Mm-hmm. So, or as we call him, Indiana legend Adam Driver. Not really. John Goodman, who is John Goodman. Okay.
Yeah, I think that's all you have to say about
John
Goodman.
That's all you have to say is John Goodman. And for our last one, Garrett Hedlund, who is Johnny Five, was Flynn Jr. in Tron Legacy. So, pulling that one. So, there's the geek is strong in this movie.
I guess I should also mention with Garrett Hedlund, I actually first saw him in Friday Night Lights, and that was the movie that impressed me about him. And, well, he hasn't done a whole lot that I've been capable of keeping up with him on. He has impressed me on some of his work, specifically when it comes to Tron and Inside Llewyn Davis. And he was in Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, but yeah, then he did Mudbound, and I have a feeling we'll have to do something on Mudbound.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I'm looking forward to it. Yeah.
Okay.
But not because of him. It was not because of him. All right. So I do want to bring up one quick thing about the behind the scenes. The cinematographer who is not, the usual Roger Deakins, but is Bruno Debonnell. And believe it or not, we've actually talked about him before. And, we talked about how this movie's drab in colors. It's interesting considering that two of his biggest movies that he's done is Amelie and Across the Universe.
Which are, like, super
and
colorful,
one
right?
One thing that you can absolutely say those two movies are not is drab.
Mm-hmm.
Just saying. And if it also helps, he also was the cinematographer of Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. And I don't have to tell you that you know, that particular director is also not known for using lots of drab colors. So there's that.
Mm.
All right, so are we ready to call it?
I think so.
Should be, yeah.
All right, Kent, Chris, do you agree with the critics on Inside Llewyn Davis? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe? Kent?
This is definitely a pass for me. So even though it's this weird style that I'd like to call fun depressing, because it is kind of a depressing cycle, but it's very nice to watch, and it's very kind of fun to watch, and you don't feel completely drained watching it, and you want to go back and hear about outer space again, so it's a good movie, so yeah.
Chris?
It's a pass for me as well, pretty much for the same reasons. I love the cast. I love the soundtrack. I feel like it's something that anybody who has any sort of artistic kind of talent will relate to in some capacity. And it's just a solid pass for me. One of my favorite Oscar Isaac roles, really. So pass, definitely.
Kent, I'm going to be honest here. When you announced that you wanted to do this movie...
out of nowhere.
House Legends.
Yeah.
I was seriously wondering, oh crap, I'm going to be failing yet another Coen Brothers film.
Oh.
This is going to be awkward. But at the same time, I was eager to watch this movie again because, again, it just confused me. And before watching it for this podcast, I would have said Inside Llewyn Davis would have been on the bottom end of the Coen Brothers' work. Watching it this time, really kind of looking at it, really digging deeper into it, and paying more attention to certain aspects to the film, I'm realizing here that while I'm not going to call this one of their most brilliant pieces of work, I think that this is a movie that is probably more misunderstood than most. And I think it's one of those that you really kind of have to savor and really think about and really take some time to develop why you think the characters are doing what they're doing. Because if you just give them very superficial motivations, yeah, this movie is going to feel very inauthentic. But if you realize that Llewyn Davis is a complex character, someone that is both good and obnoxious at the same time, who's not perfect, who is... I want to say probably the polar opposite of the dude, then you can kind of appreciate the struggle that he's going on, where he is in his life. And at the same time, this is also kind of giving us an insight in kind of how the Coens themselves look at themselves and look at their work and contemplate a future where they aren't together. And at some point, that might happen. It could be that there might be a falling out, or it could be that one of them passes away. And if that happens, what will happen to the other? And I think in a way that this was their way of exercising that fear a little bit, or at least thinking about it. And in that sense, this movie takes on a whole new dimension. And I'm going to say this probably now on the higher end of their work. Maybe not in the top 5, but definitely within the top 10. And so, yes, I'm going to actually give this a pass. And I strongly recommend. Now, this isn't one that, if this is your first Coen Brothers film, go with something different. Go with Raising Arizona. Go with Big Lebowski or Fargo, for that matter. You know, No Country for Old Men would probably be more accessible than this movie. And that's saying something. But, yeah, Inside Llewyn Davis is a movie that, if you give it patience, if you really contemplate what the movie is trying to say, and if you can keep yourself awake, because let's be honest here, if you're in the wrong state of mind, you're gonna fall asleep like it's nobody's business.
Like Sean Goodman, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he was more chemically induced.
potato, potato.
Oh wow, you think that people are gonna be so nauseated by this film, they'll turn to drugs? That's a little steep. All right.
You never know.
Yeah, we'll go with that, I guess.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to turn to
this. But no, this is a pass. And I'm actually looking forward to watching this again. I'm going to pick up the Criterion version of the film and give it another go, probably in about another year or two.
Okay.
But now it is time to leave the world of the Coens and head to a little island off in Indonesia and tackle some hardcore badass action.
So this is your idea, right?
Yes, it is.
So why don't you introduce this?
Well, what is there to say? There's a tenement building with a whole bunch of convicts. There's a SWAT team coming in, and all hell's about to break loose. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, it is the action powerhouse that is The Raid Redemption. Gentlemen, I cannot wait to talk about this movie. Although, I have to tell you right now, get yourself a neck brace because this movie's going to kick your ass. Just saying. But that will be next week. Now, bear in mind that we do have more episodes coming along. If y'all didn't get a chance to check out our fan art episode on Black Panther, I strongly recommend that you do so. We are going to be having more coming up. I think the next one will probably be on A Wrinkle in Time. I know we're also looking at Ready Player One later on this month. And, of course, as we get closer to summer, expect more of those. Also, you'll also notice pretty soon we're going to be having something called Geek Critique with me and Chris. And we're going to talk about the art of film critiquing. And honestly, I cannot wait to get into that and for you to see what we have to say on the matter. And of course, if you have anything that you want to bring up about any of the shows that we're doing, you can certainly do so on our Facebook page as well as on Twitter at Arthouse Legends. Or if you want to send us just a simple little email, you can do so at arthouselegends@gmail.com. We look forward to anything you have to say, even if it is to tell me how much of a douchebag I am, which is okay because everyone is. But gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me for this episode. This is the Movie Dude Eric.
This is Kent.
And this is Chris.
And B.